Hi. All
Thank
right.
you.
Excited to be here.
Hello. All right. Did you enjoy your hour off? You had some nice healthy food for your gut. All
Yes.
right.
Our gut. We had lots of prebiotics,
All right.
probiotics, fermented foods.
Nice, nice. So, why don't you go ahead and tell the audience about how you got into this? And a little bit of what you've been doing the last few years in this field.
Want me to start?
Yeah, go ahead.
I would say, yeah, I mean, and like we had mentioned previously, but kind of filling in some of the gaps, we were always and still are filling in gaps based on the needs, right? First and foremost, it was our needs where we were sick, we were our first patients, and we're like, okay, what can we do to fix this? And now it's kind of gone broader to like our patients' needs, our community's needs, and filling in those gaps. So everything we do up till why we even started the private practice and are integrative and have looked
Programs.
into functional and are and made programs and everything has been out of a need. So that's really brought us to where we are today. And even what we research and what we educate on is all based on a need where we feel that there is a massive need to heal and help restructure the gut microbiome.
And I know, we when we were learning about plant-based nutrition, it made it seem like if you just go plant-based, all of your issues will be solved. And so people like me who had gut issues, one, didn't feel 100% better, and two, were really struggling to even incorporate the plants. So we were very determined to offer solutions to those who maybe had gut issues and were having trouble eating and digesting and tolerating the plants, or maybe needed a plant-based version of one of these elimination diets. So that was a huge motivation for us for, people to say, that's a great idea in theory, but it's hard for me to apply it. So we wanted to really teach the how.
Great. Thank you. So, for people who weren't watching earlier in the day, the Marins had given a talk all about the gut and misconceptions in gut health. So, if you missed that, this is kind of the Q&A for that. That's how we're gonna do this. So, one thing I have that I think a lot of people who try to eat healthy have a struggle with is overeating. How do you suggest people try to prevent overeating other than just sheer willpower?
Well, one of the tips that I shared earlier, which is just good for digestion as well, is to plan your meals well and in a well-balanced way so you're not constantly snacking and grazing. Because I really do find that that is one way that people really overeat. They don't realize that this little snack here is extra calories, this little other snack here, this extra drink that they're having in between their meals. So really just having three solid, well-planned meals is not only better for your digestion, but it prevents that overeating as well. Because if you are planning your meals with sufficient fiber, plant protein or protein in general, healthy fat in that meal, you are more than likely going to be satisfied. I think one of the biggest things I see is people just don't eat enough protein in their meals and they're not satisfied. They're eating an hour or two later and then they're bloated all throughout the day.
If I could touch on, we just recently did an episode on our Good Gut Life podcast about my health journey, and overeating is a big part of my health journey and what got me into like a situation where I was like, how I need to get out of this, right? I need help and I need to find solutions. And part of that was this hedonic eating. It's this idea of you're eating not for hunger, you're eating not for health, you're eating, not for your wellness, you're just eating, right? And for
Mindlessly.
me, it's like mindlessly eating. And for me, there's huge emotional components. And even that is connected to gut health. As we were mentioning earlier, I mean, serotonin and melatonin and just these neurotransmitters that are produced by your gut, but also your emotional wellness, where it's like we know early adverse life events, right? So whether that is some form of abuse at a young age, whether that's verbal, physical trauma, we find in studies that those who experience this trauma at an early age are anywhere from 150 to 350% more likely to have IBS and to have some type of gut issues. So the data is there, the research is there. And so there are elements that linger even with overeating, where you're eating almost at, because it's what you did when you were 5, 10, 15, 20, and it just lingers into adulthood and you're like, I'm just overeating, right? And there are many root causes to that, but those are a few.
So how do you, so what would you do if you're overeating? How did you break that hedonistic eating ritual?
Yeah, I think boundaries are healthy with foods, just like in any relationship. And I always mention to my patients, it's important to really consider the food you're inviting into your home almost like a guest, where you really need to assess your relationship with that food because it's going to be staying with you for weeks or sometimes months at a time, maybe days if you're eating that food very quickly or if it's a small portion. But just like any guest, you wouldn't just be like, hey, person I have a really unhealthy relationship with who makes me feel terrible after. Come stay with me for a week, or like come stay with my family for 2 weeks, and I'm not going to feel my best around you. So I think just assessing even what's coming into your home and into your healthy space is so important. So you just know the appropriate boundaries. There are certain people where we're like, I love you, but maybe I'm just going to see you on the weekends. I really don't want to see you every single day, or aunt so and so, let's just see each other on holidays, or maybe let's take a break from one another. So I really feel like those healthy boundaries with certain foods is really important. And then boundaries also include, again, that kind of time restriction where you're just not giving yourself that free for all to be eating all day, every day.
Yeah. And just to take it personally as well, yeah, it was kind of a combination, right? Where I understood, oh, okay, yeah, kind of what Dahlia is explaining of these are the foods that are going to live with me. I know when I have healthy foods in my pantry, in my fridge, I've cooked them, I'm going to eat them. If I do have some of those unhealthy foods, let's say, or those ultra processed foods, it kind of goes back to some of the foods I used to eat when I was younger, and they're tempting. They're kind of talking to you. We all see those memes or reels where it's like, why are you looking at me? Like, hey, like I want to eat you. But really, and so the other piece of that was addressing trauma, was doing emotional release, was doing therapy, and looking at those. Just as you want to be healthy physically and you're looking at food, there are also spiritual and emotional components that you cannot ignore. So really getting to those was key to where, even if the food is in your house for whatever reason, it's a party, there were leftovers. It's not taking hold of you. It's not going back to you need the dopamine of the food to counteract this negative emotional feeling that you're feeling, because it's never going to be enough food. If you have those negative emotional feelings, again, it's a hole that you cannot fill. Food isn't going to fill it. It just goes with alcohol and even other hard drugs. We're all trying to fill that void. But it's getting to the root. It's taking an integrative approach to that void and going, why is this void even there to begin with? And let me address that. So that is key.
So what I'm hearing is that the food is the symptom in that particular scenario, and you have to address the emotional or psychological root cause.
Totally.
So, on your journey in, with gut health, what is the most surprising thing that you learned?
I have one little, I mean, one, because very early on, and even what we're hearing more often is like parasites are horrible. You get a parasite, oh my gosh, parasite, this, I mean, the list can go on and on of all the horror stories and videos online. But like, parasites are actually part of our microbiome, and actually parasites can have beneficial effects, and actually bacteria help to balance healthy bacteria populations help to balance a healthy parasitome. It's literally called the microbiome. We have a mini parasitome, which is a parasite microbiome. And so it's really just allowing those parasites to get out of control and wreak havoc. That's when it becomes an issue. But reading studies and realizing, oh my gosh, there's a parasitome, like that's pretty cool. And what do they do? And that was pretty cool, I think. But I don't know if you have.
And, you know, just like parasites can be somewhat of a stressor on the gut if they are out of balance. One thing that I cannot enforce or emphasize enough is just how insidious stress is. Because I have people who come to me and they're eating the perfect diet, they work out, you know, the perfect amount of time, they're buying all the supplements, they did everything they should. But their gut's not getting better. And really, what I find is it's stress. So, if you don't have healthy coping skills for that stress, you will really literally just swallow it down into your gut and it will throw off all of your little gut bugs that you have living within you. So, really having healthy coping skills for the stress is so important because my patients who just don't get better, it's not because we didn't try everything with diet and, you know, supplements and movement and sleep. It's really just they don't have a healthy relationship with stress management. So important.
In that regard, have there been certain healthy coping skills that you have found more effective than others?
I mean, I would say just for example, it's kind of just an awareness. It's almost like starting small and practicing with consciousness and awareness, right? And that kind of helps when, let's say, we're working with a patient and they just realize like, oh, I don't have a normal bowel movement, or my gas isn't normal. This bloating I'm feeling is abnormal, and so that begins this view and this almost shift in perspective of just this awareness, this consciousness that shifts, and we kind of just go with that, and then you become aware like, oh, my work isn't conducive, or where I work isn't conducive. Oh, the person I'm in a relationship with isn't conducive to what I'm doing, right? It just kind of opens this door, and you start to see, okay, I'm starting to see what's a little abnormal, and that just continues to go into from your body to your home to your work to your relationships to your community. And we've seen patients, and we've even done this ourselves, but you kind of shift from like, those were my friends, and maybe they're not really following me right now or suiting me right now, and just kind of shifting who is your community, who's your tribe a little bit, right? Do they have the same values as me? Because we say something, or this is one of our quotes that a lot of our patients and followers really like, where it's like, sometimes it's not just the food you're eating, it's who you're eating with. And so it goes into those relationships where is the person you're always eating with making you stress, and you don't realize it until one day that shift happened. You're like, wow, like you're really stressing me out here. So it's that micro consciousness that leads into this big change for sure.
And that can look so different for everybody. Some people are journalers. Some people are really great with verbal processing. Some people like listening to sounds or podcasts that really help kind of de-stress them. So I think it's really important for each person to understand how they best process stress. If movement is helpful for you, then find a movement that feels great and intuitive to you. If processing it, find a healthy place to offload that because it maybe isn't your family who always wants to hear that offloading or can tolerate really or hold space for it. So really understanding how you process things is so important. So that way you can create those micro awarenesses and keep growing in the way that each person processes. And that'll help you process your food.
Right. So you mentioned when we were talking about how to stop overeating, you mentioned eating enough protein. How much protein should a person try to get into their daily diet?
So it really is going to depend on their activity level and what stage they are. So that's really going to kind of dictate what is going on with the person. But in general, you want to go for about 1 gram of protein per kilogram body weight if for an average adult. So excuse me, in order to find kilograms of body weight, you want to take your weight in pounds, divide it by 2.2. Unless you are way outside of your ideal body weight, then you kind of want to find out your ideal body weight. But take your ideal body weight divided by 2.2. You want about a 1 gram per kilogram. So that's going to be anywhere from 10 to 35% of your calories, just depending on what your needs are. So super important that we're getting in enough protein. For an average female, I will say, who has a pretty balanced body composition, body mass index, that's going to be about 25, 27 grams per meal. For an average male, it's going to be 30 to maybe 35 grams per meal.
Great. So as a percentage of one's daily calories, what kind of percentage is that? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, so I can range 10 to 35%, like say on an average 2,000 calorie diet. That's an average. But then yeah, like the equations and kind of customizing it a bit depending on activity level, age. Clear. I know Dolly and I are pretty active. Like we do try to work out at least 6 days a week. We do weight training. We want to maintain a very. I like to squat deep and heavy, and it's like we want to maintain that muscle mass throughout our age as we
And
age.
bone
And
density.
bone density. And so that's where we'll be on the upper end, on the higher end. And it is. And part of that awareness is also feeling your body, right? Like it's okay to be sore. It's okay to break down muscle tissue. And then it's how are you recovering? Are you still sore several days after that workout, right? Are you having any tightness and stiffness and, nerve pain or joint pain? And so it's assessing that and going like, okay, well, let me look into this. Let me actually do that equation. Let me see what I'm eating, because we may think like, oh, I'm getting enough. I'm eating my meals, but you're looking and seeing, okay, what's actually in this meal? What's it composed of? And we do that exercise with our patients where we go, hey, track for like a day or two
Or a week.
or a
I
week.
usually don't recommend a week.
And so it's like you don't have to do that every single day, but a nice little snippets of information and timelines here and there help to really go, oh, I am getting enough protein, or oh, I'm not getting enough. So
But I will say, for most people, it's about 18, 22% of their calories that should come from protein. So I know there's some out there who say if you're eating enough calories, you're eating enough protein, but that's not always true, depending on the age and the stage that somebody's in and their exercise. So somebody can be really overstimulating themselves and be in a more catabolic state where they're breaking down a little bit too much because they're not getting in enough protein, whether it's plant protein or other types.
If someone's looking to add in protein, what would you suggest that they add in?
So on a plant-based diet, especially, I would say go for what I call high-ticket items in every single meal. So that is going to be something like tofu. So soy-based tofu, I especially will recommend going for the high protein or the super extra firm because there's more protein per concentration. That could be tempeh, that could be pomfu, which is pumpkin seed tofu, or a lower fat option is going to be something like fava bean tofu. Those are all going to give you anywhere from 17 to 25 grams of protein per 4 ounce serving. So those really give you a lot of bang for your buck. It could also be things like a protein powder. I use a pumpkin seed protein powder where just organic cold pressed pumpkin seed is the only ingredient, but they've concentrated the protein from the pumpkin seed. So you're eliminating the fat, super low in carbohydrates. But I usually will use a protein powder at least once a day, whether that's in my matcha or a dairy-free yogurt that I'm having or anything else that I'm making that it makes sense in. I always recommend going for those high-ticket items. Instead of beans, I will say choose a legume pasta because beans by themselves really aren't the most concentrated protein source. You maybe get 5 to 8 grams in about a half cup serving of black beans, pinto beans. Most of the beans are lower in protein. So I'll say go for the pastas because if you're eating lentil pasta or chickpea pasta, you get about 24, 25 grams per 4 ounce serving. So you're not eating more of the food. It's just in a more compact form. So really going for those high ticket items can be so important. And others that are pretty up there as well, nutritional yeast, spirulina can be great add-ons, or even things like chickpea flour if one tolerates them, but really making sure you're getting that protein density. And that can be so important for your gut healing as well, because our gut, like I was mentioning, is made up of skin, and it's impossible to heal properly without enough protein. I used to work in the hospital, and when we had patients who had injuries or they had even burns, you had to make sure they were consuming enough amino acids and enough protein. So the same goes with a hyperpermeable gut, that it's going to be hard to heal that permeable gut if you're not eating enough protein.
So Do you make a distinction between whole foods versus processed foods with regard to health?
Totally.
There's a spectrum.
There's a spectrum. There's a processed food spectrum, and it's a we do educate on like processed foods is not necessarily like a bad word. It's not the scary word. For example, when I make a smoothie, that's a processed food, right? I'm processing those foods. When
By blending them.
tofu is technically a processed food, tempeh is technically a processed food.
Even frozen fruits and vegetables, that's a processed food. Somebody's processed it by washing it or peeling it or cutting it. So it's so important to distinguish that spectrum of things because ultra hyper processed foods, that is where fiber stripped away or, nutrients that you really want to consume are being stripped away. So they're ultra hyper palatable. That's on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. But concentrating certain nutrients, whether that's legume, pasta, or tofu, yes, there is processing to it, but that's not necessarily a deleterious thing. In fact, you're just really compressing a nutrient or a macro or micronutrient that you're wanting to get more of. So, such a difference there. So important for people to not be afraid of processed foods. Because sometimes when people are on the whole food plant-based diet, again, they're not even eating tofu, they're not using anything outside of a whole plant food, and they have gut issues, it's really hard to get in enough nutrition. You have to eat such high volume, and sometimes you're still falling short of, again, protein intake and some of those macro and micronutrients. So I think that that's really important to recognize where you are.
And don't get us wrong, like we love regenerative organic. We love the idea of the way nature intended it, and we totally lean that way, and that is ideal. It's just where we are, especially as a practice, and seeing just the number of patients we see, we understand that there's a therapeutic use sometimes for these foods. And we see, like, we try to pull the best from integrative and Eastern and functional, but at the same time going, okay, here's where some Western and some other areas where it makes sense to use. And I think a great example is like white rice. For so long, we've been demonizing white rice. And yes, like I'm not here saying eat all the white rice you want to eat, right? But at the same time, it's understanding, yeah, brown rice and forbidden rice and purple rice, all these other grains are really great. And you want to get that fiber, you want the whole plant food. That's
Antioxidant.
wonderful. When you do have someone who is in severe dysbiosis, has severe overgrowth, they're not going to be able to handle that. So do we just say eat no grains at all? Well, no, that's where like an organic white rice can come in, where you still can get resistant starch. Depending how you cook it and how you preserve it, that resistant starch is going to feed healthy gut bacteria, and white rice is a nice stepping stone for those who are needing to rebuild and restructure their gut microbiome, right? So it's hard to just say this is bad, this is good. There is a gray area, and that's where it comes in as just the right context, the right medical nutrition therapy, and what's the goal. And then ideally, yeah, the person is eating more quinoa and forbidden rice and these whole grains, even gluten-free whole grains like buckwheat and amaranth and all these wonderful things. But early on, if they are having severe gut health issues, it's going to be very, very hard for them to do. So to just say, eat whole foods and good luck, it's like, well, and that's our niche. That's where we help those people go, like, I tried to go plant-based, but I couldn't. It's like, well, yes, you could. Here's the context, and now you're going to be able to tolerate those foods. So, yeah.
So, in your experience, what are the early signs that someone's gut bacteria may be imbalanced even before overt digestive symptoms appear?
I mean, I would say the blanket kind of really. Any chronic symptoms you're having can be related to the gut, which is kind of is crazy to say, but the more and more research that is done, the longer we've been doing this, we go really anything from post-nasal drip to sleep apnea to migraine headaches,
Bad breath.
bad breath to, I mean, the list goes on and on. Foul-smelling gas, even though it's like, oh, it's just once in a while, it's like something's going on, right? And then when we connect the dots, when we keep asking questions, when we kind of dig deeper, you realize maybe multiple chronic issues are going on at once. And when we put that together, they go, oh yeah, this is kind of bigger than I thought. And then there's a gut element there. So yes, the obvious, like, you know, my stomach hurts more often than not. I have loose stool more often than not. But even the not so obvious, right? Like I do suffer from migraine headaches and I do get some joint pain. I have an autoimmune issue. Even diabetes, like diabetes is going to affect the gut. And we always like, was it the gut or was it the diabetes or which caused which? And there is a gut element to healthy insulin and healthy pancreatic function. So the more and more research, it's like, everything is related to the gut, and it's either a starting point or it's an end point. So it's on that spectrum, which is so much. I know it's a weird answer, but like
I don't
it's
know.
true.
So you were talking about stress a little bit earlier, impacting gut health. How does gut health impact how you handle stress, or can it cause you stress?
So we do know that more signals actually go from your gut to your brain than go from your brain to your gut. 80% of signals are sent from the gut up to the brain that can influence then stress and mood, then are coming from the brain into the gut because our gut bugs themselves are responsible for producing our neurotransmitters. So our dopamine, which helps us feel happy, over 60% is produced by our gut bugs. Our serotonin, about 70 to 90%, is produced in the gut as well. We have things like GABA, which also kind of chills you out, just like serotonin does, is produced in the gut. So we have so many of these neurotransmitters produced in the gut. If the gut itself is highly inflamed, unhappy, overwhelmed, it's going to be hard to produce those neurotransmitters that help with anxiety and depression and balancing your mood and your sleep. So it's so important to really understand some of those things could be stemming in the gut. In fact, I was just speaking with a friend the other day who is a psychiatrist, and he was saying, "Hey, you know, I see with so many of my patients that I'm giving them all the therapy that I can, but there's likely a nutritional and a gut component that's off. How can we collaborate on this?" And it's so important to really understand which bacteria can be helpful in producing certain neurotransmitters and how we can decrease inflammation in the gut to decrease some of those symptoms, some of those moods that we just don't attribute to what's going on in our gut.
Great. So, for someone who is struggling to get cruciferous veggies in their body, but because it causes bloating, but they really want to try, what do you suggest? I'm actually reading someone in the chat comment, and they commented, you know, freeze dried broccoli sprout powder. What are your thoughts?
So, really trying them in different ways can be helpful. So, with broccoli, we know, for example, it's the stem that is a little bit more fermentable. There are more fermentable carbohydrates. So, maybe with broccoli, you're getting pre-digested broccoli that was pre-frozen. And then maybe you're cooking it and blending it into a soup, and perhaps you're just using the florets, the tops, and you're not using the stems. So not only are you kind of pre-digesting it, and there's now smaller sulfur compounds and smaller FODMAP compounds there available for your gut bugs, because if you're blending them up and doing all those things, it's not a huge buffet, it's just small little morsels of food. But then again, you're decreasing the FODMAP content by just eating the florets. Something also that not a lot of people talk about is something called molybdenum. So molybdenum is a trace nutrient, and we are supposed to find it abundantly in the soil, but like we talked about earlier, our soil quality is changing. And so we're finding now a lot of people, especially those who are iron deficient or maybe are copper deficient, are also molybdenum deficient because it is a micronutrient that helps that balance between iron and copper. So our iron, our copper, our zinc, our molybdenum help one another stay in balance. Molybdenum can be a trace mineral that one tries when they are eating cruciferous vegetables, especially if they're finding they're not only bloated, they have that rotten egg smelling gas. Taking molybdenum when they eat those foods can sometimes decrease that. So those are a couple tips that I would
Yeah.
suggest.
And we all open our cruciferous leftovers and get that nice fart smell in our face. And that is the sulfur compounds. And so this is a natural process. However, like Dahlia is saying, in your microbiome, in a healthy microbiome, you have this balance to manage those sulfur compounds, to manage all the biochemical processes going on. And so when you don't have that, when there is something missing, like Dahlia's saying, some of these attributes and molybdenum and just the, like she said, pre-digesting can be helpful in this to mitigate that. If you're still finding that there are issues and you know it's with cruciferous vegetables, then this is where it's kind of like test, not guess, is where we'd go and kind of just looking into, okay, what is exactly going on? Maybe you do have, let's say, an overgrowth, and no matter what you do, because in an overgrowth, certain microbes are in a place they should not be. And just you kind of like hoping or trying little things is not going to move enough of them. So it is kind of looking into that and going, okay, what is this lingering problem that's not going away? And so with the right kind of testing, we can identify that to go, oh, it's this. This is XYZ or why that's happening. So, yeah.
So with the proper testing, can you get that specific as to what this specific thing is that you need, or is it more trial and error?
Yeah, certain tests can tell you if you're lacking digestive enzymes, or they can assess the bugs that are living in your gut. So again, if you have some of those sulfur-loving bugs, certain breath tests and stool tests can assess for them to tell you if they are the ones who are causing the discomfort when you're trying to eat these cruciferous vegetables and these sulfury vegetables. So there are definitely tests out there that can kind of help you understand your biome a little bit more deeply.
And you mentioned bad breath, and someone's asking about taking probiotics for many years, but they still have chronic bad breath. What do you suggest?
So one thing that a lot of people don't talk about is there's a lot of biofilm that can accumulate in the mouth. And so when you go in for a dental cleaning, part of what they're scraping off is not just debris, but it's also bacteria and other microbes and this little protective shield that they create around themselves called a biofilm. And this biofilm is comprised of things like carbohydrates and proteins and fats and minerals and iron that protect them because they don't want to leave. Your mouth is a comfortable place for them. But biofilm is one thing that's frequently found in the mouth. So using compounds with enzymes can help sometimes break down those biofilms. And that's kind of one of the ideas with things like oil pulling, when people will do coconut oil swishing. Coconut oil is very rich in enzymes, and some of those enzymes can break down biofilm in the mouth. So people will gargle it and kind of swish it in their mouth, and then they'll spit it out. They're not swallowing it, because if you're breaking down some of these biofilms, you don't want to swallow them then into your gut. You want to spit them out. So that's one way of doing it. You can also use things like apple cider vinegar, which is enzymatic rich and can kind of break down biofilms in the mouth. Or there are certain toothpastes as well that have enzymes in them or have properties like colloidal silver. We use a toothpaste in our home that has colloidal silver in it to help prevent some of those biofilms from building up, because colloidal silver also is a really good biofilm disruptor. And then there are specific probiotics that are specific strains that are meant for the mouth. So looking for a dental probiotic is really important versus just taking an oral probiotic. If you're swallowing a probiotic capsule, usually that doesn't get opened up and activated until it hits your small or large intestine. That's not always going to reach back up and go into the mouth and benefit the mouth. So a lot of the oral probiotics are lozenges, where you're going to suck on them and not swallow a capsule. So that way they can do their thing in your actual mouth and really help. And there are a couple that I really like. One of them that we have used personally, we had our daughter use this oral probiotic just to continue to support her oral microbiome, was from BioGaia. And it is their Prodentis. And it is just a little lozenge that you suck on. But again, it contains some of the strains, the lactobacillus and bifidobacteria strains, that are important for the oral microbiome. So it could be different delivery form, and it could also be important that you're breaking down the biofilms.
And if someone was to use those lozenges, what would they expect to experience? You know, would it clear up symptoms? Would they notice certain health in their mouth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So usually that's the case. They're supposed to have less kind of hot. People will tell me, I have really hot breath, and it just seems really musty, that my breath is very thick and, just doesn't smell good. And my coworkers or my siblings or my spouse will tell me that my breath just is always very strong. So they should expect alleviation in that symptom. They should expect to feel it as well. A lot of times when there's biofilm buildup, you feel it. So some people will feel like their teeth are grimy all the time, like they're coated in something. They can't wait to brush their teeth, or maybe they're brushing their teeth 3 to 4 times a day, but it's just coming right back the next time they eat. That should expect to alleviate as well.
Right. And then just real quickly, what are your thoughts on mouthwash and tongue scraping?
Yeah, I love this topic because we've actually done quite a bit of research for our daughter who was born with two a lip and a tongue tie. So this is something that is highly prevalent but not talked enough about, which is the tongue and lip tie, which can then restrict your mouth. And this gets into an area even beyond us, but we've definitely taken a deep dive into it. But it's like orthotropics and myofunctional therapy. So really, this is just saying the physiology of the mouth, right? And especially for kids, this is huge because in the techniques we used and what we've done for our daughter, we've helped her avoid orthodontics, which are braces, right? And so by using techniques, and more so than mouthwash or tongue scraping, it is keeping your mouth closed. And this is not just for kids saying don't speak, but this is like, for example, we have it right here by our desk, mouth tape. And so you've seen that it's all the rage lately. You're seeing influencers mouth tape, but this has been an ongoing thing. We've been doing it for,
About
man,
5 years.
about 5 years. And so we tape our mouths at night just so our mouths aren't open. So I think some of the misconceptions here is like sugar is going to cause cavities. Well, no, sugar feeds the bacteria left in your mouth, and they're aerobic bacteria. And they will be fed, and then they'll produce acids that then break down your teeth. And so, really keeping your mouth closed and nice and the salivary glands active and keeping your saliva and it moist and brushing with hydroxyapatite. And yes, you can mouth scrape. You don't really need super harsh mouthwashes to then go in there and rinse everything out. You're also rinsing out the good bacteria. It's more so saying create an environment for the good bacteria and the good microbes and not the not so good microbes, and that will be a game changer. Since we've done this shift, we've seen no cavities. I mean, I've seen no cavities in myself where I used to get cavities every once in a while. I'm like, why? Well, my mouth was open when I'd sleep and I'm drooling on the pillow, right? And so I didn't have the best oral health at a young age. I had braces. I had an overbite. My mom let me suck on a pacifier for a very long time. I ate lots of sugar with an open mouth. So all these things in combination create this dysbiosis in the mouth that can then be transferred further down into the gut. And that gets into even more issues. So, we know the family member, the friend with lots of cavities, always getting dental work done. Their mouth looks like a silver mine. If you're an older adult, it looks like a silver mine. If you're younger, they have, I know, the
Porcelain.
white porcelain finish. But overall, it's like, that person that's always in the dentist, and it's just these foundational things you can do for your mouth that really make a huge difference.
So if you're a mouth
And what about?
breather, something important to address.
Yes.
Absolutely. And what about gum health? And a lot of people have receding gums as they age. Can any of this stuff help, kind of regrow or at least maintain their gums?
So, if somebody has receding gums, constantly inflamed gums, it's very likely oral dysbiosis. So, that's really important to assess. And now, dentists, I've seen more patients bring me reports, oral microbiome reports from their dentists, which is really cool. So, the dentist will assess their saliva and check which bugs are living in their mouth. So, a lot of people are coming back with certain bugs like Porphyromonas gingivalis, which is an inflammatory bug that's going to live in all the little crevices in your teeth. And if they're there, they're inflaming and irritating your gums, which can cause receding gums. So it's so important. If it's not hormonally driven, it definitely can be microbial driven. So it's so important to assess for some of those things. And yes, some of those same strategies, like James was mentioning, the hydroxyapatite, which can build up mostly the teeth, but colloidal silver, the apple cider vinegar, the coconut swishing, the dental probiotics. Proper, structure of the mouth and closing the mouth and mouth taping, these can all be really helpful.
And really quickly, because we love to do analogies. I mean, I love environmental analogies. I think we are connected to our environments and they parallel so well. You can think of your mouth almost like the tide pools, right? There's high tide and there's low tide. If we restructure the beach too much, we mess up these tide pools. We mess up the low and high tide, but there's a low tide and a high tide for a reason. The high tide protects all the little crabs and anemones and sea cucumbers, and there's life there, right? When it's low tide, then the birds come and the predators and they eat, and you're creating this balance, right? When that's thrown off, it's just like the mouth. You have all these creatures living in there. You have predators, you have commensals, and you're feeding them. And it is, it's like, hey, there's high tide. I'm talking, my mouth is open, I'm swallowing. And then at night, I'm going to sleep, close my mouth, and it's going to be nice and moist and protected. And you're going to do it all over again the next day. So there's these ebbs and flows, just like we see in these bigger ecosystems that we also need to maintain as well.
And then just what you're eating, right? Eating enough fiber, ensuring that you're building the teeth up that way. But the antioxidants, green tea, for example, is another one that people can swish. And just getting in those antioxidants when you are active and eating throughout the day can be so, so, so important.
So what about for somebody who has been on antibiotics and kind of wrecked their gut with antibiotics? How do you then go about rebuilding a healthy gut?
So our biggest tip with antibiotics is if you can prevent the use, do your best to do that. Sometimes they are important and they can be life-saving, but oftentimes we find that they're kind of just prescribed as like, hey, just something's wrong. Here's an antibiotic. Leave my office, you know? So really asking your prescriber and your prescribing physician or provider, like, why are you prescribing this to me? What are the risks and the benefits of me taking it or not taking it? What would be an alternative if I don't want to take it? Really understanding, like, is this dire and I need this antibiotic? Or can I try something else first? Is this going to kind of sort itself out? Like, if it's just a cold or a virus, let it pass, right? Do things like rest and hydrate and nourish your body. So, the most important thing with antibiotics is trying to prevent their use and really limit their use as much as you possibly can. You know, I know those of us who grew up in the 80s, 90s, even the early 2000s, or just in that time, antibiotics were given out like candy at the doctor's office. So, a lot of us had our fair share. But if that is you and that's the case, which that was me, I took so many antibiotics in my lifetime. Really just trying to nourish the good bugs as soon as possible is going to be so important. So, refeeding them, eating fermented foods, which contain probiotic strains in them is so, so, so important. So eating them with every single meal is going to be so important. Getting in prebiotics, so those probiotics are fed and those probiotics are getting their own food as well, is just so important. And then really just figuring out how you got there. Like, were things off and you got really sick because you're not resting enough? Then we got to work on that. Are you not sleeping enough? Really trying to prevent the next course of antibiotics from ever being needed. So just re-nourishing who you do want there. If there was someone who came in that maybe was taken advantage.
And how long does it take to usually rebuild a healthy gut after antibiotics?
So it can take a few weeks to a few months. Studies show it can take, on average, about 4 weeks a month to recover your kind of native microbiome once again, if you return to your habits that you were previously practicing prior to the antibiotic administration. But that can vary for people. For some people, it's quick. Within a couple weeks, they're back to themselves. Stools are normal again. They feel normal. They feel great. I think it really depends on what you're coming in with. If you're coming in with a very fractured gut, it can take some time to build up a healthy gut again or work towards that again. So it's going to really depend on how rich your microbiome was before you got into the antibiotics.
And a quick parallel again, just kind of what we see. I mean, we've all seen an empty lot, right? Just a dirt lot. And we may see that. And then the next week, we see it overgrown with plants. Where did those plants come from, right? How did this empty lot grow plants? Did gardeners come in and plant all the plants? No, naturally in the air and probably in that soil, dormant were seeds. And if you just leave the empty lot, those seeds are going to sprout. And we call some of them weeds, but We believe, I believe, all plants have a purpose, and some of those plants are edible, and some of those plants are for pollinators, and you start to build this ecosystem. So our gut is very similar. Bad things can happen to it, but with the right, if we've hopefully been doing the right things before that happened, it's going to reseed and resprout. And that's where the appendix comes in, ancillary organs come in to help. But overall, our gut, a healthy gut especially, is going to reseed and kind of resprout itself. And that's where we focus more on, yes, probiotics are great, but also the prebiotic aspect, like Dahlia's saying, right? And even supplements and things that help, you know. Gut Nurture is one of our favorites, and this is a great powder. This also has a molybdenum in it. And so finding these formulations that do multiple purposes and can really help kind of be that almost gut compost and help anyone's gut, as opposed to trying to be that gardener going, no, you need these plants. And it's like, well, those plants are from South America, but I live in Alaska. It's okay. These probiotic plants are great. It's like, well, wait a minute, I'd rather focus on healthy soil, and then any plants anywhere you live can grow. That's like focusing just on the healthy gut soil, and it's what you're eating, it's certain powders that are helpful, and kind of going from there and building from there.
You mentioned the appendix. What's the role of the appendix in this process?
So the appendix is actually a reservoir for certain gut bugs. I know people say the appendix is a useless organ. It's not. It does have use. So it can infuse healthy anti-inflammatory bugs back into the gut microbiome if it's struggling a little bit. The appendix wants to be there to help. It's a gut supporting organ. And the other thing that it does, I kind of think of it like Spider-Man, where it's shooting off what's called biofilm. So I talked about those biofilms that these bugs can create around themselves to protect themselves. But the appendix can also actually make biofilm to protect you from the bugs. So if it's recognizing, hey, there's that sulfur bug again, and it's gonna bother Dahlia, let me give her some biofilm to kind of wall it off and stop it there and protect her from it. Now, you don't want too much of that because then you get this thick biofilm buildup in your colon, but the appendix is just trying to help you. So if you did take antibiotics, the appendix can come in after and be like, oh, hey, I see that you're missing these strains of lactobacillus, these strains of bifidobacteria, and these different other strains that you need, let me give them back to you because they are supposed to live here and they were living here before.
Okay, so it's almost like a bacteria bank, if you will. Bank. Okay. And one of the participants is asking how to cure dyspepsia.
Yeah.
That's a loaded question, and it can be because with dyspepsia, it's a type of reflux. And one thing that we always start with when somebody comes to us with any type of dyspepsia or reflux is motility. If you're finding things are coming back up this way instead of moving their way down, because your gut should be kind of a one-way river, you really want to find, is there anything impeding the flow, including constipation? So really making sure you are not constipated. And so many of my patients who have chronic reflux, acid reflux, GERD, dysfunctional dyspepsia, they might have chronic constipation. The other thing you want to work on is, again, is anything else coming up like gas? Do you have SIBO? Do you have any type of gas that's constantly putting pressure on your sphincters, those little doors that you have that compartmentalize parts in your GI tract? Because you have a little door that separates your esophagus from your stomach to keep the acid in the stomach out of the esophagus. You have another little door that separates the stomach from the small intestine. It's called your pyloric sphincter. You have that ileocecal sphincter, ileocecal valve that separates your small from your large intestine. So, is there so much gas in any of these areas that the doors are just being burst open, and now that is pushing acid up? So those things can be so helpful in understanding that. And then, there's other things to consider. Does one have a hiatal hernia? Is there almost a little doorstop where part of the stomach has come back up through that little door and is acting like a doorstop? So now acid's just kind of always coming up. there are different ways to manipulate a hiatal hernia, whether that's using gravity and doing something like a rebounder trampoline. There are certain ways to have it readjusted and pushed back down, or even using diaphragmatic breathing and exercises like that to breathe and calm the diaphragm and move the diaphragm back down as well. So really just making sure nothing's bringing anything back up. And we know certain compounds can be helpful as well with dyspepsia and with reflux, whether that is something like ginger, which can be very relaxing and very soothing. We also know melatonin in some studies. So very low dose melatonin, 2 to 5 grams of melatonin at night, if one isn't sleeping well, can be helpful with relaxing the sphincters as well. One of my favorites that I like to use if somebody is struggling with one of the other things and is kind of on their journey, but having reflux in the meantime, is something called sodium alginate. So this creates almost a little bubble that can keep the acid in the stomach to protect the esophagus, because after months or years of acid coming up into the esophagus, it can slowly start to erode that tissue and inflame it enough where it's starting to transform and become precancerous, and then it can become cancerous in something called Barrett's esophagus. So something like sodium alginate is a nice little temporary cap on the stomach, and it will kind of coat the stomach and prevent that from happening. And then, you know, you have other things like using a wedge pillow and sleeping upright, not eating within 3 hours of going to bed. Some people will use things like alkaline water before going to sleep, things like baking soda in water, alkaline water, or even calcium chews like Tums. I wouldn't recommend using all the time. I actually have had several patients who come to me and they have acute pancreatitis that gets induced from too much use of Tums, because all that calcium is deacidifying the stomach so much. And I mentioned earlier, you do need the stomach acid to tell the pancreas it's its turn, that when the pancreas is low functioning, it's actually able to become inflamed. And so you don't want to reach for those Tums or those calcium supplements too frequently.
She told you it was a loaded question, didn't she?
Yes. Yes. Just unloaded. So what are common food responses that indicate a problem?
Common food response? Like
after when you eat something, what would be a response maybe early on where you're like, okay, I think maybe something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can eat a sulfury food and have the foul smelling gas. That is either you're stressed, something's going on. So for like radish, broccoli, think of the cruciferous, think of radish, like allium family. And so you eat that, and within even hours, you can then have foul smelling gas. That's an easy sign of going like, oh, what was that? Or speaking of motility, you think of transit time, right? Mm-hmm. How often are you having a bowel movement? So I had a full day of eating, and it's the next day or the next morning even, and I haven't had a bowel movement. And then it becomes midday, then it becomes end of the day. And then the next day comes. And so if you're going multiple days without a bowel movement, that in and of itself is already a huge red flag of going like, wait a minute, why am I not emptying? And so I don't know if you have...
I would say any symptom that kind of onsets within a few hours consistently of you eating, whether that is brain fog and fatigue, you might have post-nasal drip and you're constantly clearing your throat after eating, you have acid reflux, you have the bloat and distension, you have the flatulence. All of these are going to indicate your body's trying to tell you something. Not always that something's off. Like I was mentioning, if you're constipated, you could immediately feel gassy right after eating something. That doesn't mean it's the food. It could just mean you need to have a bowel movement. Your colon is signaling that it needs to empty, because your colon and stomach have a very strong communication signal between them. It's called your gastrocolic reflex. And so if you just eat a whole huge plate of food, but you're full in your colon of stool, your colon's going to be like, whoa, hold on, slow down. I am still full. So just to let you know, I need to start trying to compact things and move them through before I can handle that. And granted, it's going to be hours before that food in your stomach hits your colon. It takes anywhere from 14 to 32 hours to get that food from your stomach into the toilet the next day. So several hours need to transpire between the two. But you might immediately feel gassy, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything's going on with the food. It just means you're constipated. But looking for those other signs and signals that are uncomfortable, irregular, whether it's irregular frequency of gas, irregular smell of gas, irregular frequency of stool, appearance of stool, or again, it could be something higher up like the reflux, the postnasal drip, the coughing, the fatigue.
So you mentioned brain fog during that answer. What would be a common cause for brain fog?
One of the most common that I see is either a food allergy or intolerance or a histamine response. And that is why so many people will say, I went on the AIP, the autoimmune paleo diet, and I had so much less brain fog. I went on this extreme elimination diet, the low FODMAP diet, and I had so much less brain fog. A lot of the times that is a histamine response. And when people are decreasing their intake of those histamine foods, a lot of the times they have less of that brain fog. So it can be your body's signaling indicator that, hey, I don't like this. It's activating the immune system. Chill out on that food.
But again, but it's not the food per se, like especially if we're talking about whole not foods or minimally processed, healthy plant foods. It is asking the question, why is my body not able to tolerate these histamines in food? Why is my microbiome unable to properly break down and process the histamines? What's going on? So it is asking those questions and digging deeper, as opposed to just saying, yeah, it's a histamines. Don't eat histamine or foods high in histamine, right? Avoid these foods. It's like, no, it's digging deeper for sure.
Right. During your talk, you mentioned mold being a problem. I think you may have mentioned black mold. I'm not sure. I put it down as a note. So what happens if you're exposed to black mold to your microbiome?
So yeah, there are certain more insidious strains of mold that will just elicit an inflammatory cascade. So those histamine symptoms are often ones that are experienced with those with mold. So they might find whenever I come into my house or a certain room in my house, I have an allergic response where my eyes are really itchy or watering, my throat's itchy, or I get really bloated. So they could have any of those histamine symptoms that we were discussing earlier during our talk. Or they could find my things are changing. You know, I had a optimal thyroid function, liver function, hormone function very recently. And now my doctor's saying my thyroid is off. My liver function panel is off. My hormones are off. I'm not sleeping. My mood is changing and I'm much more anxious. So these are usually some of the signs that something is going on. And a lot of the times it is a biotoxin in the living environment, and mold tends to be the most common one. I think people are becoming more and more aware of mold, and now more laws are being put into place where they're in people's favors, whether that's with builders or with landlords, if somebody's renting. But it's so important to really take that time to kind of assess, was this always going on? Did something change? Is there something in my environment? A good way to tell is really pay attention. If you're on vacation and you're out of the house, do you feel significantly better? Do you have more clarity? Do you have better digestion? Is your sleep improving? Your mood's improving? Everything seems to be better. And then right when you come back home or in your workplace, wherever you're being exposed, are all those symptoms back again? And definitely assessing your climate. Certainly if you live in a more moist climate, a more humid climate, you're much more likely to be exposed to mold or be exposed to some of those mycotoxins. So it can be really important.
So do you just need to get rid of the mold, or do you need to do something to clear the mold out of your body?
So it really depends on the person. With certain genetic mutations, some people struggle to detox on their own. Because I do sometimes have patients who the wife is really struggling and the husband is not, or vice versa, or maybe just one of the children in the house is really struggling, and everyone genetically could be different. Some people are fine and just having their regular detox functions that are regularly happening, like bowel movements, urination, sweating, that's fine for people. But I do have some people who, in addition to either remediating the mold or leaving the moldy environment, we do try a detox protocol where we'll put them on binders. And this can range. This can be anything as simple as activated charcoal or bismuth. to things like apple pectin, all the way up to prescription strength binders. Some of my patients have gone on things like cholestyramine or cholestipol, which is a prescription strength binder, and they're actually prescribed to bind cholesterol, but they're also very good at binding some of these biotoxins. So that might be necessary at times. Sometimes an antifungal is necessary if it's caused significant shift. So they might go on either a prescription like Diflucan or fluconazole or an over-the-counter herb like Uva ursi or undecylinic acid or caprylic acid. So it really just depends on the person, but really recognizing, are any of your detox pathways struggling? Because you do need to open those up and really ensure that you are efficiently able to sweat. If you're somebody who says, I can't sweat, I overheat if I am trying to sweat and I'm trying to sauna or do something like that, we need to work on that. You have to slowly increase your tolerance so that way you can use your skin as a detox pathway. If you're saying, I'm super constipated, it's going to be really hard for you to detox those things. So we need to really work on your gut. Make sure you're not constipated. We need to hydrate you. Make sure you're urinating. We need to work on your breath and make sure that your lungs are working at their highest capacity because breath is another way to detox. So it just depends on the person and kind of their level of exposure and their affinity to get rid of those things.
And this is where we're being smarter about prevention. I mean, this is a very interesting topic, and just taking it to another perspective is where we're seeing adobe buildings pop up more. We're seeing this movement, especially in the wellness community, and it's definitely been on my radar for a long time. Earthships and just alternative ways to build, because we're realizing, I like history, but if you go back in history, the reason we started building with timber is because of our geographical location, is because of how cheap it was, is because of how readily available it was. If you go to where my aunt is from, like Morelia, Mexico, they don't have timber forests there, right? They have stone. So they have dirt. And so a lot of the buildings are hard stone dirt walls. And so it's funny that one time, one of our family members was like, I punched a hole in the wall. And everyone there was like, oh, haha, like funny. Like it's a joke, but here we could easily punch a hole in our wall. It's drywall, right? We can throw something and we have a hole in the wall. They can't fathom that there, because what you're joking. It's like, no, the walls aren't stone here, they're drywall. And so the houses we build here in the US, we're in California, but in most of the US, is very susceptible to mold. So it is rethinking in a way to help prevent a lot of these mold issues from even happening, especially like Dahlia's saying, in the wetter climates where it's just not making much sense, but we still do it. We've just set up this whole industry for it, and it's going to take a lot of time to change things for sure.
So, what are your thoughts on intermittent fasting?
Yes. So in that, I mean, that's a large umbrella, but under the umbrella is one of our favorites, which is more specifically time-restricted feeding. And that's just saying, in this time frame, I'm going to eat. In this other time frame, I'm going to fast. And so, another way to say that simply, where everyone can do it, is called sleep for the most part, right? It's saying, I'm going to bed at a good time. Let's say, ideally for me, I go to bed at 10 o'clock. Wonderful. I probably stop eating at around 9 o'clock. And then I usually then wake up very early, and then I don't start eating till about 10 or 11. That's my time restricted feeding. That's my window to fast. And then then I have that window to eat. And that is that time restricted feeding, which is a form of intermittent fasting. And so,
And usually we'll suggest, try not to eat about 3 hours before you go to bed. So if you are going to bed around 10, try to cut it off around 7 p.m. But yeah, we would say minimum is a 12-hour fast every night. If you can go to 14 or 16 hours overnight, that is really, really helpful. So that is what we would suggest. Some people will do a monthly or a quarterly longer fast, and that is still considered intermittent fasting, where for a whole day of the month or a whole day in the quarter, they're just water fasting. That's still considered intermittent fasting because intermittently they're practicing this fast. So for those who can practice that time-restricted feeding out overnight, that can be really important. I had mentioned also between your meals, practicing that time-restricted feeding where try not to eat for 2 to 4 hours, at least, I would say probably 3 to 4 hours between your meals. That can be so important and so meaningful for your gut because you need that time of a break.
So during the during your presentation, you were talking about digestive enzymes, and how do you know which digestive enzymes you need, and what brands are there that people should use that you guys trust?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain foods that are really rich in enzymes as well. So, for example, pineapple is really rich in bromelain, or papaya is really rich in papain. So, some brands will even sell like papaya enzymes, and it's just papaya seeds that are encapsulated. So, you can start with foods. Kiwis are another one. Ginger is another food with digestive enzymes. Fermented foods have digestive enzymes in them. Apple cider vinegar, like we talked about, has digestive enzymes. So, including that in your cooking or your food can help. And then it depends from there what somebody has going on. You can really tailor digestive enzymes from there. Like I was saying, molybdenum is a trace mineral that can almost be considered a digestive enzyme for sulfur. So that could be one. We put molybdenum in gut nurture. So that could be a source that people are looking for molybdenum. Or there are other brands out there for somebody who's recognized, I don't digest FODMAPs very well, and I need an enzyme that helps me break down FODMAPs. There are brands out there. There's brands like FODMATE or FODZYME, and these are highly specific enzymes that are breaking down bonds between these carbohydrate chains. So they're making them a little bit more digestible, whether that is fructose or fructans or galacto-oligosaccharides. These enzymes can help break down or denature those bonds. You also have other types of enzymes like DAO, which is an enzyme to break down histamine. So, Nature DAO is one of our favorites to use for that. And then you just have your kind of run-of-the-mill, broad-spectrum enzymes. One needs to know what strength they need. Even just going to your physician and requesting a stool test and asking, hey, can you test my pancreatic elastase? That will kind of tell you, do you need pancreatic strength enzymes? And those really have just a higher concentration of lipase to break down fat, protease to break down protein, amylase to break down carbohydrates. So there are, Vital Nutrients is one that has a vegan pancreatic enzyme. That's one that I sometimes will like to use or sometimes like to suggest. Or I really like if somebody doesn't need that level, but they do need a digestive enzyme, maybe they're an IBD or a celiac patient, or they're post-SIBO. So we know their intestinal villi, where we're supposed to make enzymes, are kind of recovering or were damaged. Maybe they need a little bit of help. I'll just recommend a broad spectrum digestive enzyme. Pure Encapsulations has a pretty good one. I think it's called Digestive Enzymes Ultra, or Enzymedica is another brand that I like with just broad spectrum digestive enzymes. I don't think everybody needs enzymes, but if you do need them, they can make a significant difference with gas and bloating, indigestion, stomach cramping. But it's really figuring out what do you have going on and which enzyme is going to be best for you.
Great. Well, that concludes our time. I really appreciate all the information you shared with us. I think you guys did about 3 hours and 15 minutes today. So I appreciate all of it. All right. Well, that concludes the day. If we can just unmute the audience real quickly so they can show their appreciation for the Marins.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.